From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. It was one of the biggest highway projects that Kansas City, Missouri had seen in years. A 10-mile, six-lane corridor running south from the heart of the city. To widen the existing road, the construction company brought in huge earth movers and thousands of pounds of explosives to blast through the limestone hillsides. Then, early in the morning, on November 29th, 1988, a call comes in to 911.
Yes, I want to report a fire.
What about?
Two security guards working at the construction site are on the line.
Yeah, there's a fire on both sides of the highway. It's at 87th Street.
87th and 71 High. What's burning? Okay, we don't have units there. Thank you.
The 911 operator quickly notifies the fire department, and they rush a crew to the scene. Pumper truck 41.
41, dispatcher.
The firefighters spot a pickup truck in flames and a second fire.
Appears to be two arson fires out here. Send the police.
Two arson fires.
Pumper 41, please caution on your call. We have information there may be explosives. It's in a construction area. The pickup truck.
The explosives are packed into two construction trailers. Another fire truck arrives, pumper number 30. As both crews begin to battle the flames, the battalion chief reports a powerful blast.
107 reports a major explosion. We heard it here. Firefighters are involved out of that 71 highway in 87. Apparently a large explosion. Pumper 41 or pumper 30, answer. Pumper 41 or pumper 30.
There's no answer from either crew. Authorities cordon off the area. 40 minutes pass, then a second explosion rocks the site, breaking gas lines and shattering building foundations miles away. Emergency crews, investigators, and news reporters arrive as the morning sun reveals a charred landscape.
The only thing left out of the two fire trucks on the scene is the front end of one pumper. Everything else is gone.
And about 12:30 this afternoon, a contingent of firefighters rolled in. Their job was the hardest one today, to bring out the remains of six of their friends.
Everything was pretty much leveled within probably a 100-yard radius.
Victor Zinn is a retired Kansas City homicide detective. He was at the scene that day.
In addition to the bomb squad, they also had cadaver dogs looking for individuals that may have been blown apart.
Six firefighters died in the explosions. The youngest was 31, the oldest 57. It was the worst tragedy in the history of the Kansas City Fire Department.
This was a huge, huge crime that took place, and there was going to be a lot of time and effort put into finding the right people that did it.
9 years later, five people were convicted, not for murder, but for aiding and abetting arson that led to the deaths of the firefighters. A federal judge sentenced them to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But from the beginning, the case was troubled. First, there was no physical evidence linking the suspects to the crime scene, and there was conflicting testimony, a lot of it from convicted felons and jailhouse informants. To this day, the four surviving defendants maintain their innocence, and they're not alone.
In my opinion, the wrong people are in jail for this particular crime.
The youngest defendant was Brian Shepard. Brian was just 17 at the time of the explosions, and it turns out his age was really important. A few years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that a mandatory life sentence without the possibility of parole was unconstitutional for a minor. And that's just the type of sentence Brian received. So, after nearly three decades behind bars, he suddenly had a shot at freedom. Reveal's Jenna Welch spent a year digging into Brian's case, together with our partner, Kansas City Public Television. And a lot's happened since we first reported the story. Jenna begins with a phone call.
Receiving a call from
Brian Shepard,
an inmate at CCA Leavenworth Detention Center.
Whenever Brian reaches out from federal prison, our calls are monitored, and we're only able to talk for 15 minutes at a time. So if you want to get to the bottom of his story, it takes a lot of phone calls. This call was just over a year ago.
I realized today was the 29th of November, and
Brian tells me on this day, he thinks about the firefighters and their families.
It's hard to believe that it's been 28 years today that that crime happened. You know, it's...
I mean, it's the day your life changed forever, and it's got to be hard.
It's hard sitting in here for all these years. I've been locked up for 20-plus years now. Anybody who digs into this case and starts reading about it and investigating, they just... they come to the same conclusion. Something's not right with this case, you know. If we can maintain our innocence for all these years and stand up and fight, you know, and never waver, something's got to be wrong.
Brian has always told me, and anyone else who would listen, that he was home asleep on the night of the explosions. He was living with his parents in a place called Marlborough, a working-class neighborhood just a mile from the construction site. The other defendants were also from Marlborough, his uncles Frank and Skip, Skip's girlfriend Darlene Edwards, and Brian's friend, Richard Brown. Brian's teenage years were wild. Lots of drugs, drinking, fights, and brushes with the law. During the time the police were investigating the explosions, Brian was locked up for stealing a bicycle and violating probation.
Brian Shepherd is in jail already.
That's when local media started reporting he was a suspect in the firefighter's case.
He was scheduled to be released next week, but investigators and prosecutors will reportedly charge him with arson and murder before he walks.
The evidence against Brian came from two men he'd met in jail. They told police he'd bragged about starting the fires. Based on their testimony, the state of Missouri indicted Brian on 6 counts of murder. But within a couple of months, the case fell apart. One of the informants, a man named John Driver, said on television he'd lied to the police.
98% was made up, was fictitious.
Driver said the police wanted a conviction badly and promised to reduce his jail sentence.
The statement was made by the police officers was someone's going to have to burn for this. They were getting a lot of pressure down to convict someone on this charge.
Brian Shepherd had not been in jail that long when the prosecutors had to drop the charges.
Tom Jackman covers crime and courts for the Washington Post. Back then, he was a young reporter with the Kansas City Times.
They dismissed 6 murder charges against the guy they had thought had killed the firefighters. This was a gigantic letdown for the entire city. Suddenly, they had nothing. They had nobody. They were back to square zero.
So in December of 1989, Brian Shepherd was a free man. But he was still in the media spotlight.
And Shepherd, in an exclusive television interview, maintains he's not capable of the crime. But he says since his name has been associated with the explosion, his life has been scarred.
I had a friend of mine who looks kind of like me. He got jumped down on Westport by, I think it was a couple firefighters, jumped him, beat him up because they thought he was me.
Brian talks a lot about this moment in his life, as if it was twilight, just before the light went out. On one hand, his attorney told him his troubles were over.
He told us nothing's going to happen. They're not going to charge you with the thing anymore. We've proven their witnesses were lying, so just move forward with your life.
The police had dropped the charges, but Brian was still under suspicion.
The people hadn't changed, but the way they looked at me had. I could see it in their eyes, you know. I could see it in the way they act around me.
He remembers seeing investigators combing Marlborough for evidence.
You know, I might as well be walking around with a sign on my chest or a bullseye or something.
An array of law enforcement was trying to crack the firefighters' case. Local police, the FBI, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF. They were part of an arson task force, and Fire Captain Joe Galletti was the chair. The men who died were his friends, his brothers. Joe firmly believed Brian Shepherd and the others set the fires that triggered the explosions.
All the time, we knew what family of persons did the crime. All we needed was a little evidence.
Just a little evidence. But remember, any physical evidence was blown to smithereens, and no eyewitnesses had turned up. But Joe figured someone out there must know something. So his team set up a hotline for tips and plastered reward posters across Kansas City.
And we made signs 30-foot long and 12-foot high, and we put them on all the bridges. And I made it big enough that if you could drive by at 55 miles an hour, you could read it.
Joe worked with an ATF agent named David True. They brought the case to the attention of the TV show Unsolved Mysteries. This was 6 years after Brian Shepard's first case was dismissed.
Today the case remains Kansas City's most notorious unsolved crime.
The show aired in February 1995.
There is currently a $50,000 reward being offered in this case. If you have any information, please contact the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, or call our toll-free number. Remember, you need not give your name.
Joe Galletti says as soon as the program ended,
the telephone started ringing. We had over 300 leads that night, and things started happening.
Leads were coming in from ordinary citizens. They were also coming in from jails and prisons.
I don't think you could get on the phone for 3 days. There's so many criminals calling.
Alan Bethard is from Marlborough, and he grew up with Brian Shepard. I spoke with him at a Missouri State prison where he's serving time on drug charges. Alan's been in and out of prison over the years for dealing drugs and robbery. In fact, he was here in 1995 and remembers prison staff putting up reward posters and encouraging inmates to call into the tip hotline.
Never once have I seen any kind of help being requested from inside the Department of Corrections. They've never done anything like that.
Alan says he didn't call in. Investigators came to him with an offer.
Testify at the grand jury hearing. We'll let you out of prison. Testify at the trial and help get a conviction, and we'll assure you the $50,000 reward. We'll put you in the witness protection program. We'll send you anywhere in the United States you want to go.
Alan says investigators wanted him to confirm his story. One of Alan's friends had told the police that he and Alan together had seen Brian Shepard and others speeding away from the construction site just after the explosions. But Alan says he was at home that night and told investigators the story wasn't true. He says that's when they came after him.
They personally came at me, threatened to put me in jail for withholding evidence, threatened to take my girlfriend's daughter for being an unfit mother and set my bond at $1 million, set my trial date back for 3 years, even though they know they didn't have anything on me. These guys are threatening to take your life away from you.
Alan still refused to cooperate. At the time, he was facing charges for stealing a car that he'd driven across the state line. The federal prosecutor in the firefighter's case had the charges upgraded. Suddenly, Alan was facing a long sentence in federal prison unless he cooperated.
I would have been a good witness against Brian, with me being so close to him, me being such good friends with him.
But just at that point, the judge in the case intervened. He scolded the government for pressuring Alan to testify. Reporter Mike McGraw spent years investigating the firefighter's case for Kansas City Public Television and the Kansas City Star. He's interviewed Alan many times.
During the hearing in which Alan Bethard's stolen car case was taken from state court to federal court, the judge turned to Bethard and he said, "Look, I'm sure the Federal Sentencing Commission would never, never in their wildest dreams anticipate that the government would pull something like this."
Then the judge turned to the federal prosecutor and said,
"You're just prosecuting this guy because he won't tell you the story that you want him to tell." He even called the prosecutor out again and said, "Do you think maybe that Alan is telling the truth and your witness could be the one that's lying?"
Instead of prison time, the judge gave Alan probation.
Prosecutors aren't giving up. They're still on the hunt for people who will testify against Brian Shepard.
They're coming straight out of jails out of Missouri or Kansas. And we'd look at our attorneys and be like, "This person's up there testifying against me? I don't even know who this person is."
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Byer Duncan here from Reveal's engagement team. Say what you will about 2017, but it was a great year for investigative reporting. And our show covered a lot of ground. We investigated the rise of Germany's far right. We took a close look at President Trump's promise to build a border wall. We dissected that viral Pizzagate hoax. And we reported from some of the most divided places in the country. We can't choose our favorite episodes. That'd be like picking a favorite child. So we want to hear from you. What episodes or moments jumped out at you this year? Let us know, and we'll create a playlist based on your selections. Submitting is easy. Just text BEST to 63735 and follow the prompts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson.
Reports a major explosion. We heard it here. Firefighters are involved out of that 71 Highway 87.
The explosions that killed six Kansas City firefighters in 1988 happened at the site of a major road expansion project. Investigators suspected Brian Shepard and four others snuck onto the site and started fires that triggered the blasts. But there was no physical evidence and investigators couldn't nail their case. The investigation stretched for years, and in the middle of it was a highly decorated ATF special agent named David True. Witnesses interviewed by True said he could be persistent and polite, but also threatening and manipulative. Here's Reveal's Jenna Welch.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, 1, 2.
The scene is a small interview room at a Kansas City jail.
For the record, it's February the 19th. 1995, it's approximately 9:35 p.m. This is Special Agent David R. True, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Sitting opposite David True and another federal agent is Darlene Edwards. She's the girlfriend of Brian Shepard's uncle Frank and was living with him at the time of the explosions.
About ready to conduct an interview with Darlene Edwards regarding her knowledge about the firefighters incident, which occurred in November 1988.
This is one of the most important interviews of the entire investigation. It's a Sunday evening, the end of a tense weekend for Darlene.
For the record, once again, Darlene, tell us what you know about what happened that night.
After I'd come home, okay, Frank and I had come home. He was drunk, went to argue as usual, right? We went to bed, I pacified him, he passed out.
Darlene has waived her right to an attorney. She tells the agents a story. Hours before the explosion, she was home with Frank. She says Brian Shepard and his friend Richard Brown walked to her house to ask for a ride to a convenience store. They told her they were four-wheeling with their truck near the construction site and ran out of gas. Darlene says she drove Brian and Richard to the store, and they filled the gas can.
I took them down to Quick Trip. I usually kept.
Then she tells the agents they went to the construction site. But when they got there, there was no truck.
Right? And I said, what do you need gas for then? Right? You know, because it's like, I don't see no cars around. What do you need gas for? What's going on? And they said, well, we're going to start a fire at this end over here. We're going to start a fire over here. So while they're over there, we can be over here. I said, man, that's not cool because you don't know where these, explosives, because they're excavating. So naturally there's explosives and you don't know where they're at. And I'm not hanging around and getting my ass blown up.
So they were going to use the gasoline to set a fire for a diversion.
Darlene explains to the agents Brian and Richard wanted to divert the attention of the security guards so they could steal some equipment. That was more than 22 years ago. I talked to Darlene recently, and here's what she has to say now.
I told them the stupidest story I could think of. I mean, come on.
Darlene says the story she told investigators was made up and didn't even make sense. The construction site was only two blocks from the store, so why would Brian and Richard walk more than a mile to Darlene's house only to have her take them back to the store to get gas?
I'm not thinking anybody's going to believe that stupid story. Who's going to believe somebody's going to do something that dumb? But they were like, okay, that's good. You put them there. Now what went on? And I'm like, okay, they said they wanted to start a fire and blah, blah, blah. And so I just lied to them. I lied to the ATF.
Darlene says to understand why she lied to the ATF, you need to go back a couple of days before her interview at the jail. ATF agents had asked her to come to their office to answer questions about the case.
They were asking me questions about the firefighters. Originally, do you know who did it? And I said, no. Well, we think you know. We've had word that you know. And I said, but I don't know. I can't help you with something I don't know.
Darlene says the agents told her that Brian Shepard and Richard Brown were responsible for the arson and that she knew about it. Darlene insisted that she was home in bed that night and didn't know anything. So then, investigators put the squeeze on her. They revealed that undercover agents had secretly recorded her selling 11 grams of crack cocaine to a friend. Darlene was arrested and put in jail.
they were kept telling me, that's your window of opportunity. You're facing 40 years in prison. All you need to do is put them there at the site. That's your window of opportunity. Take it. Go through there. Walk through that door. Go home to your kids.
After a weekend behind bars, Darlene says she had another meeting with the ATF agents, the one captured in the recording. That's when she told the story about driving Brian and Richard to the construction site.
I didn't want to be in jail. I'd never been locked up like that before. That was scary. They kept me in solitary, in a cell by myself, and they wouldn't even let me make a phone call until after I spoke to them. And I lied. I wanted to go home.
Darlene eventually recanted her statement, but it was too late. Prosecutors used the recording to help indict Brian Shepherd, his friend Richard Brown, his uncles, Skip and Frank Shepherd, and Darlene herself.
Five people have been indicted in the 1988 firefighters explosion. Their names...
Each defendant could be subject to a maximum sentence of life in prison without parole and a $250,000 fine.
The trial began in January 1997. Since there were no eyewitnesses, the prosecutors relied on statements from people who said they'd heard the suspects admitting their involvement in the crime. Brian Shepherd remembers some of the witnesses were brought to the courtroom directly from jail.
And I'd say probably half of them, we didn't even know who they were. They're coming straight out of jails out of Missouri or Kansas. And we'd look at our attorneys and be like, this person's up there testifying against me. I don't even know who this person is. You know, I've never met that person before.
But the prosecutor's most important witness was Darlene Edwards' own daughter, Becky. She was only 11 years old at the time of the explosions. Becky told the court that a week before the blasts, Brian, Darlene, and the other defendants were together in the kitchen getting high and making plans to steal equipment from the construction site. Reporter Tom Jackman was in the courtroom covering the trial for the Kansas City Times.
Becky Edwards was very tense because she was obviously terrified. She's now a teenager, 19 years old, and this is 8 years later, and she was just terrified that she was incriminating her mother, her mother's boyfriend, her mother's boyfriend's brother, and these other two fellows that she knew well. She was on the stand in federal court testifying against her family. That was definitely a linchpin moment in the trial in which here is a witness that puts all five people in one room.
After 2 days, the jurors handed down a unanimous verdict. Guilty. Later, the judge sentenced each of the defendants to life in prison with no possibility of parole, including Darlene. She's an inmate at a federal prison in Texas, where she'll likely be for the rest of her life. The verdict was a relief for relatives of the firefighters killed in the explosions. Debbie McCarnan was married to Robert McCarnan. When he died, he'd been a Kansas City firefighter for 20 years.
I thought it was a long time coming. I really never thought it was going to happen.
Debbie spoke at the sentencing hearing.
I looked at each one of the perpetrators in the eyes as I was on the stand and spoke of all six men and their families. They didn't lead good lives to begin with, like all of these men that were in their communities and did good things and helped people all the time. These people were not that type of people.
As for the relatives of the defendants, all these years later, there's still a powerful mix of anger, frustration, and fear. Becky Edwards, whose testimony helped convict her mother, wouldn't talk to us. In fact, she hasn't talked about the case with anyone in years. Not reporters, not even her own mother's lawyer. So we went to see Doris Clark. She's Becky's grandmother, Darlene's mother. Doris lives in Osceola, about 2 hours south of Kansas City. We meet outside a thrift store where she volunteers.
That was my granddaughter called me and I was on the phone with her.
Was that Becky?
Uh-huh.
How's she doing?
She's doing pretty good.
Doris takes us inside to a back room.
She should never have been on the witness stand. I mean, she should never have been called, as far as I'm concerned. So she had it rough.
Doris says federal agents, including David True of the ATF, manipulated her family and then betrayed them.
We felt that we had support from ATF. They kept telling us that Darlene was innocent.
She says the agents treated her like a queen during the trial, even paying for rooms at a local hotel. She and her husband were also invited to the ATF office during breaks for donuts and coffee.
It was just like you was going to a friend's house and entertain, and then we'd all go to court.
According to Doris, federal agents were also paying for her phone calls to Darlene in jail, and they'd give her questions to ask her daughter.
This was a setup from the get-go. It was somebody wanting to get a feather in their cap, and they should have had it in their butt.
So if you had a chance to sit across the table from Dave True and let him know what you were thinking and feeling about all of this, what would you say?
I'd tell him to kiss my ass. He had used us. That's the way I feel.
In 2005, Becky Edwards recanted. She signed an affidavit saying the ATF pressured her to give false testimony. The ATF wouldn't talk to me about the case, but I was able to talk to Agent David True, who's now retired. I met him at the Firefighters Union Hall in Kansas City. He wouldn't let me record him, but I can tell you what he said. He said he never told Doris Clark that her daughter Darlene was innocent. Doris was cooperating in the investigation because she believed Darlene was involved. What's more, True told me, Doris encouraged her own family members to provide evidence supporting Darlene's guilt. As for Darlene's daughter, Becky, the prosecution's star witness, True said she gave multiple statements implicating her mother and the other defendants. He said he never pressured anyone to lie. In addition to Becky Edwards, seven other witnesses who testified to the grand jury or at trial recanted. Of course, that leaves many other witnesses who haven't recanted, but when you go through their testimony, it's full of contradictions. I went with reporter Mike McGraw to his newsroom at Kansas City Public Television. Mike has a spreadsheet, 10 feet long, double-sided. It lists 58 witnesses who testified for the prosecution.
My spreadsheet shows that 47 witnesses changed their stories in the 9 years between the crime and the trial. In other words, in many cases, they might have told the local police right after the explosion, I know nothing about this case. Mm-hmm. And when the feds take the case over 8 or 9 years later, they all of a sudden have these epiphanies about what they do remember. And of course, when the feds took the case over from the local authorities, there was another incentive, and that was more than $50,000 in reward money advertised in most of the jails and prisons in both Kansas and Missouri.
On a whiteboard, we list the names of the defendants in one column. Alongside, we write the locations where witnesses reported seeing them.
So the information that we just pulled and put up here puts Brian at four different places, clearly at four different places at the time.
At approximately the mm-hmm. same time.
It's almost as though no two witnesses told the same story.
Okay. Let's look at Darlene.
We've got her at home after the first explosion. We've got her at the site. Mm-hmm. We've got her buying gas. We got her at the Quick Trip. And back at home.
Okay. That's starting to be even more confusing.
Right. The trial transcript itself is over 4,000 pages long. The trial lasted for weeks. And when you put it all together, it doesn't make any sense. And even the prosecutor and the U.S. attorney at the time have acknowledged that even after this lengthy trial, we still don't know what happened up there that night.
I wanted to talk to the prosecutors, but they declined. But when Mike was working for the Kansas City Star back in 2006, he recorded this interview with Assistant U.S. Attorney Paul Becker. Becker was the government's lead trial attorney in the firefighters' case. Mike pointed out all the contradictions.
When you study the testimony, Frank was eight different places at once. Skip was four, Darlene was four, Brian was four, and Richard was seven.
Now, I know the jury heard all that and came back with a guilty anyway.
You're the first one to discover that? Is that
the, No, by no means am I the first one to discover. You probably knew that at the time.
Oh, I knew that the all these witness statements didn't match up. I mean, absolutely.
The defendants would have me ask you, how could I be in two places at once? How could your witnesses be right?
We're just relying upon their statements. No, it's... Ultimately, that's what it comes down to, is the defendants admitted the crime.
Right.
Because we didn't have any eyewitnesses, so what else do you have?
Becker said it didn't matter that some of the details from the witnesses didn't match up. What mattered, he said, was that the defendants had admitted to witnesses that they had taken part in the crime. And Becker defended the tactics the government used to get the testimony.
We make deals with people to let them out of jail. Right, the inducement is your freedom, and that's the norm in federal criminal cases, in state cases too, I guess. I mean, you cooperate and you're going to get less time. I mean, what can be more of an inducement than that? But the rule is, and it's hard and fast, is you disclose it, so that the trier of fact, the jury, can weigh that.
When you look at the number of witnesses who were either in trouble or already in jail or facing charges, state or federal, and the power that the federal government had to make all that go away, it's just stunning. But then I wondered, you know, what's the duty of a prosecutor with that much power to make sure that the induced testimony is in fact the truth?
In response to Mike McGraw's reporting, the Justice Department reviewed the government's handling of the case. Their 2011 report concluded that there was no credible evidence that federal agents improperly coerced witnesses. But there was another finding. The report identified new suspects in the case. Their names, though, were redacted.
So actually, where we're standing now is some feet below where the construction site was going on at the time.
Mike wanted to show me a marker on the side of the highway at the site of the explosions.
As you can see, there's lines in the limestone here, and that's where they drill through to place the explosives to blow the rock away.
There's an American flag flapping in the wind and six limestone crosses covered with pennies, gifts to fallen heroes, and a plaque.
In memory of our firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty at this site, November 29th, 1988.
Yeah, I mean, remember, this occurred in 88. The families of the firefighters, the whole city was mourning for 8 years. There had been no explanation for this. No one had been held accountable for 8 years. So when they gathered up these kids from Marlboro, some of them were kids, there was a march for retribution. There was a lot of pressure to give the families closure, and they deserve to have it. Truth be told, I've been here by myself more than once, kind of communing with these fellows, wondering if there's any way they could somehow give me a sign as to what they think really happened that night. I'm not sure they really do. But I'm pretty sure the government doesn't know.
After nearly two decades behind bars, there's new hope for Brian Shepherd. But there's a catch.
I'm not going to confess to a crime that I did not commit. I'll tell everybody, you know, all the things that I've done wrong in my entire life, but I did not commit this crime.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, listeners, I'm Michael Montgomery, producer on this week's show. Figuring out who was responsible for the tragedy that shook Kansas City almost 30 years ago has been a huge challenge for investigators and journalists. Mike McGraw spent years reporting on this case for Kansas City Public Television and the Kansas City Star. We've got Mike's account of all the twists and turns in his investigation and a lot more at our website, revealnews.org/KC. You can also get a peek at our documentary theater project that explores Brian Shepherd's bid for freedom. That's all at revealnews.org/KC.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. We've been talking this hour about a tragedy that happened almost 30 years ago in Kansas City. Six firefighters were killed in two massive explosions caused by arson. Five people were convicted and sent to prison for life. One of them, Brian Shepherd, was 17 at the time of the explosions. Now, in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the type of sentence he received, life without the possibility of parole, was unconstitutional for a minor. That gave Brian a shot at freedom. Reveal's Jenna Welch picks up the story.
Collect call from
Brian Shepherd.
I've been talking with Brian about his case for more than a year.
Hi, Brian. It's Jenna.
Hello. How are you doing? Good morning.
He's always said he's innocent, but he says that for a long time he stopped thinking about getting out of prison because his chances seemed so remote. But the Supreme Court decision changed that. All of a sudden, Brian was eligible for a resentencing hearing. A judge could shorten his life sentence, or maybe set him free.
It's overwhelming for something like that to happen after all of these years. You know, it was a dream. I'm like, this is not really happening.
But there's a hitch. Resentencing looks at whether the original sentence was too harsh based on the defendant's role in the crime, not whether they're innocent. This is tricky for Brian because he insists he had no role in the explosions.
I'm not going to confess to a crime that I did not commit. I'll tell everybody, you know, all the things that I've done wrong in my entire life, but I did not commit this crime. If that makes the judge decide to send me back to prison for 40 more years, then that's what's going to happen.
He reads me part of a letter he's planning to give to the judge. It's about a plea deal that prosecutors offered him back in 1995.
Many years ago, I was given the chance of freedom if I would have get on the witness stand and point to my uncles and my best friend and tell the jury that they were guilty. If I had lied to myself, I would have instead corrupted my soul.
Brian says he feels like he's in the same predicament now. Tell a lie and go free, or tell the truth and stay in prison.
I could have been free many, many years ago if I had taken the deal. I hope the families of the honorable men that died that terrible night can understand why I must again assert my innocence.
What school is that?
I think Virgie told me Brian went to...
As Brian's resentencing approaches, I take a drive with reporter Mike McGraw. We're going to see Virgie Shepherd, Brian's mother. She still lives in Marlborough. That's the neighborhood close to the site of the explosions.
The homes, a lot of them need painting. Many of them have wrought iron grating on the outside. But as you can see by looking around, there's nary a sidewalk anywhere.
Yeah, she'll yell.
We go inside Virgie's house. She's sitting in a big armchair, chain-smoking, with an oxygen tank next to her. There are pictures of Brian all over the walls.
I think if we'd had money, he would have walked. If we'd come from high society instead of just being dirt poor, that he would have walked on the whole situation. I can't say that that's a fact. But in the world that I grew up in and what I've seen so far, I believe it's true.
Virgie's always said she was home with Brian on the night of the explosions. At 45, he spent almost half his life behind bars.
It's been 21 years. His daughter grew up without him. I mean, it's just a shame.
Virgie's on the phone with Brian almost every day, talking about what to expect when his resentencing comes up.
Oh, I'd love to think, you know, time served for something they didn't do. You know, I'd love to hear them say he's not guilty, but I don't have a clue as to what they're going to do. Truthfully, I'm shocked that they've let it go this far.
The Supreme Court ruling that cleared the way for Brian's resentencing found that juveniles cannot be punished by the same standards as adults for crimes that carry life sentences. Certain factors must be considered, like age, life at home, and the level of participation in the crime. Juveniles can be sentenced to life without parole, but only in rare cases where the crime reflects what the court calls irreparable corruption. Brian's legal strategy focuses on his traumatic childhood, how he was raised by alcoholics and physically abused by his father, and how he's turned his life around in prison. Cindy Short is his attorney.
The man that sits before me every day when I go to see him is a redeemed individual. He is a person who is rehabilitated.
Cindy told the judge handling Brian's case how he kicked his drug and alcohol addictions, got his high school diploma, and worked hard to stay close to his daughter and two grandkids, all while locked up in federal prison.
There is no evidence that this was someone that you would throw away, that you would be afraid of, that could never live in society. That has no relationship to who Brian Shepherd was at 17. And if we're able to prove that, then a mandatory sentence of life in prison is unconstitutional. It cannot apply to him.
Cindy also presented evidence questioning his original conviction, like all the conflicting testimony. She included interviews we broadcast on Reveal in the run-up to Brian's resentencing. But opposing Brian's team, the same federal prosecutor from his original trial. Paul Becker wouldn't talk to us, but in court, he argued that Brian must remain in prison unless he accepted responsibility for his role in the crime. Becker said that was the only way Brian could prove he'd been rehabilitated. In other words, do the one thing Brian's refused to do for the past 3 decades. The judge wouldn't let Brian address questions about his guilt or innocence, but that's what everyone's thinking about, especially James Kilventon. He was in the Army when his father was killed in the explosions. His wife is Tracy Kilventon.
I guess you call it a gut instinct. I didn't think they had the right people.
I couldn't believe that they actually had a jury prosecute these people. None of the evidence added up at all.
James says he was so troubled by Brian's conviction that he asked a friend who was a private investigator to look into the case. And his friend concluded the government failed to put Brian or the others at the crime scene.
I shared it with my mom. Of course, she was not of the opinion of me. She thought they had the right people. And that set a rift between us.
A rift that lasted to the end of his mother's life. James and Tracy Kilventon are hoping the judge orders Brian's release. The three other surviving defendants are also in prison for life, but unlike Brian, they have little hope of getting out. Darlene Edwards is in a federal medical facility in Texas. Her health is declining, and she's petitioned for clemency without success.
Would you state your full name and spell your last name, please?
Darlene Marie Edwards, E-D-W-A-R-D-A.
The interview Darlene recorded with the feds in 1995 helped convict all the defendants, including herself. The last time I spoke with her, we talked about Brian and what she'd say to him now if she could.
Brian, I love you. I am so, so sorry I did this. I know you didn't do it. And I pray that you get to go home with your mom. Granted, I want to go home too, but I'm the one that told the lie, and now we're all sitting here.
I wanted to know what Brian thought, so I played Darlene's tape for him.
I'm grateful that she actually said those words. But to hear her now, after all these years, it does mean something to me. I believe that even though she did what she did and said what she said, she still deserves to be sitting right here with me and going back for a resentencing hearing.
On the day of Brian's resentencing, dozens of people pack into a courtroom at the federal building in downtown Kansas City. No recording is allowed, so let me set the scene. Brian shuffles into the courtroom in shackles. He smiles at his family and supporters who sit on one side of the room. On the other side, relatives of the firefighters who want Brian's life sentence to stand. Judge Fernando Gaitan reads his decision. He describes moving testimony from the families of the firefighters and the devastating impact the tragedy had on them. But he also points to the Supreme Court's decision on juvenile lifers, Brian's rehabilitation, and all the conflicting testimony from the original case. When Judge Gaetan gets to his conclusion, the audience gasps. He throws out Brian's life sentence and changes it to 20 years, time served. He's not exonerating Brian, but he's setting him free.
Ashley, I know this has been really emotional.
Outside the courthouse, reporters surround Brian's mom, Virgie, and his daughter, Ashley.
I'm so pleased with the judge's decision. I know we all are.
Yes.
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 But I could see that my father's release would not only bring happiness and joy to our family, but it would also bring further suffering to the families of the fallen firefighters.
Amen. Amen.
And for that, I am truly sorry.
I try to interview families of the firefighters. Most are too upset to talk, but one of them, Cassie McCarnan, has something to say. Her father, Robert, died in the explosions.
We are very, very disappointed in this judgment today. I think that this individual was 17, almost 18. I was nearly the same age at the time of this crime, and I knew right from wrong. I don't think he'll ever take responsibility for that because he's going to claim his innocence. And my philosophy on that is this is not a conspiracy. He was convicted. There's evidence. If someone retracts a statement, they're either a liar then or they're a liar now.
James Kilventon has mixed emotions. He's happy for Brian.
I didn't think he should have spent 21 years in jail in the first place, so I was happy for him. It's not like I call him a friend or nothing, though, but I was happy for him.
But James is also sad. He's thinking the government never solved the case. It's possible the real culprits, the people responsible for his father's death, are still out there.
I still don't know what actually went on or who was up there. Almost 30 years later, I still don't have closure. I'd like to know.
Tracy Kilventon decides to reach out to Brian. So she writes him a card and sends it to the federal prison where he's packing his bags.
Some of the families were incredibly angry. And I just wanted him to know that not everyone was angry. That, you know, someone actually agreed with the judge.
Didn't go that way.
Didn't work. That theory was...
On the day of Brian's release, I head to a federal prison in Leavenworth, Kansas. I'm with his attorney, Cindy, and his daughter, Ashley. We're riding in Ashley's minivan. Instead of releasing Brian at the prison gates where news crews are waiting, guards put him in a big white van and drive him to a Kmart store about a mile away.
He said go that way.
We get there just as the van is pulling away.
I don't know what
he's pointing. Did they drop him off in the parking lot?
Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I think
they... Oh, my God. I cannot believe they just left him there. Oh, my God. Oh, this is so messed up.
Standing alone in the Kmart parking lot is Brian. He's dressed in a thermal undershirt, slacks, and tennis shoes. And he's holding a garbage bag with all his stuff.
It's awful windy out here.
Very excited, nervous. Anxiety's killing me. Been stressing all day. Ain't had no sleep. Can't wait to get over there and spend some time with my family. I didn't know if it was going to come or not.
I'm starting to wonder today with all the waiting I've even doing.
Brian and Ashley embrace.
It's overwhelming, really.
There's a tornado brewing. The sharp wind whips their faces.
The door.
We hop into Ashley's minivan.
I'm trying to figure out why you're driving. Oh, my God.
I have my phone, John. I don't need to get it.
Brian says the guards were excited.
They almost wanted to hug me.
Yeah.
They were all shaking my hands and congratulating me and stuff. And I got a card from one of the family members' wives.
What? One of the firefighters?
James Kilventon, Jr.?
Yes.
His wife sent me a card.
Oh, my God.
Brian shows us the note that Tracy Kilventon sent to him just as he was leaving prison.
Can you read it?
I tried. I read it a couple times. I can't read it again. I was going to make Cindy read it and make her cry.
Yeah.
Brian hands the card to Cindy.
Brian, there are so many things I want to tell you that written letters can't convey. I asked my husband the other day if he thought about his dad every single day. He said, no, not every day. We all have to let go. That's part of life. We all have to move on. Not all the family feels the same way as you see on the news. My husband has moved past the hurt and anger. I thought you should know. There's much more I'd like to say that can't be written. Maybe someday we can talk. I hope you adjust well when you get out and make the most of every day. Tracy Kilventon, wife of James Kilventon, son of Captain James Kilventon. Wow.
What do you think about that?
Wow.
Huh?
Something, yeah.
I got that on my way out of the joint.
That's amazing.
Something.
I can't believe I'm out of jail.
I can't believe it. You're in my car. You're in my van.
I have somebody that wants to talk to you.
We head off to a hotel where the Shepherd family is gathering. Brian borrows Ashley's cell phone so he can FaceTime with his two grandkids.
Look who's coming home with me.
FaceTiming with anyone, much less his grandkids. Brian says that's a first.
You're on your way up here to see me. I'm out of jail.
Look at that smile.
It's been about 9 months since Brian Shepherd was released from federal prison. He's living in Kansas City, working construction jobs, and spending lots of time with his family. Recently, Brian joined forces with Tracy and James Kilventon. The Kilventons are supporting Brian in a lawsuit he filed just last week against the Justice Department. They want to force the department to release more details from its 2011 review of the firefighter's case, including the names of new suspects cited in the review, suspects who were never charged. Deb George edited our show. Michael Montgomery was the lead producer. Special thanks to our partner, KCPT, Kansas City Public Television, and reporter Mike McGraw. We also had help from the Kansas City Star. Reveal's Jenna Welch directed the play based on Brian Shepherd's case. There's more about it at revealnews.org/KC. Mwende Hinojosa is our production manager. Our engineer and sound designer is Jim Briggs, who wrote the music for this week's show. He had help from Catherine Raimondo and Kat Shuknit, while Byard Duncan played the drums. Krista Scharfenberg is our acting CEO, Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief, Suzanne Reaver is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson, and remember, there is always more to the story.